Welcome, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters Radio. I'm Veronica Entwistle. We've been running these interviews with people making a difference on our planet since 2008. And I have to say, we've really seen some wonderful, amazing, positive, evolutionary gifts from people all over the place. And I have one of these people today, Aaron Newcomb. And Aaron is involved in something that's very, very difficult for most of us to comprehend. And he's trying to help with and has created a safe house for people who are caught and under the wheels of human trafficking and need to get free. So welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Oh, well, I'm so grateful that you're here. I'm also grateful to know that there's a lot of activity out there. And I'd like you to tell us, first of all, how you got involved with this particular subject and some of the flavors or the reflections of the activity that's working on sort of making it easier for people to get out of that trap. Or how do they get into it and how do they get out of it and how can you help?
Yeah.
That's a lot of questions.
It is. It's a great question. It's a lot of questions and it's pretty involved. It's probably hard to be super concise, but I'll do my best to break it down into.
Yeah.
My wife and I learned about sex trafficking in 2007. We really had no idea before that what was going on in terms of sex trafficking worldwide or in the United States. What was disconcerting for us is how prevalent it was within the United States. A lot of it has gone on as classic sexual trafficking of individuals, predominantly women and girls, but it also affects men and boys. A lot of it goes under the guise of prostitution. And a lot of it is also under the auspices of sexual entertainment, whether that's illicit massage parlors, stripping, or pornography. But if you really break down the experience for the individuals that are used in those industries, it meets all the parameters of classic sex trafficking. In other words, there's control, there is force, there is physical abuse involved, there is economic control, psychological control, and abuse. And it's really dark when you get into it. Now, we didn't really know that that was happening. We didn't look at it through that lens before. But once we were exposed to the information and the awareness campaign around sex trafficking and looking at the components of it and then looking at the volume of it, it was shocking. It was like your show suggests, it was a paradigm shift. It was like our minds could somehow look at the reality of things around us through a completely different lens and go, oh, my gosh, there is systemic injustice that's happening all around us, and we didn't know that, and other people don't know that. Once we looked at it through that lens, we realized that there needed to be an answer. And there was a growing
Wait a second. What kind of history did you have? Are you a professional person? What's your background?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. I was a construction contractor. I had my own construction business. I remodeled homes. My wife was a office manager and an HR manager at a manufacturing firm. We have been married for many years. We have four children. They're all grown now. At that time, our kids were graduating high school, moving on to college and doing other things. So we were just kind of real average folks. And this was outside of our wheelhouse, outside of our experience. But our hearts were touched to the degree that we decided to jump into the fray and do something helpful.
I love that. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think this can happen to normal people. It was scary, but it was compelling. It was like, my goodness, there's victims out there. And what was really scary is that the victims of sex trafficking seem to be falling through the cracks of any other social services. In fact, most commonly, women who were being sexually trafficked were just categorized as prostitutes and therefore criminals. And so their interaction, there wasn't any rescue for them. They were arrested in the process at somewhere along the way, blamed for the abuses that were occurring against them, and criminalized and incarcerated. Like, that was society's answer. If they didn't fall into that ditch, then they got into when they reached a point of need, they would go to the hospital with bruises and wounds from what had happened to them, or they would go to a homeless shelter because if they left their trafficker or their pimp for some reason, or he kicked them out, they literally are penniless and homeless. So they would end up in a homeless shelter or a domestic violence shelter. Mm-hmm. Those folks were not properly really understanding the history behind the person that was in their services. Mm-hmm. And if someone did find out that they had been prostituting or sex trafficked, they became the lowest person on the society, on the rung of the ladder of society. In other words, they were despised even within systems, whether it's incarceration, a homeless shelter, or domestic violence shelter, they were despised by the other people who were there.
Wow, isn't that
I don't
sad?
Know exactly why that was, but that is
it's a pecking order, isn't it, Aaron? Tell me this. What did you encounter people that had been betrayed that way or people who had been abused that way? Is that how you started?
Well, we started with information, and then we started doing a lot of research, and we started going to some conferences where there were survivors of this, and we started talking to them personally and reaching out to them, having conversations, you know, both over email, over the phone, and in person, and trying to find some real information. And the stories that came out were heart-wrenching and gross, and it's just shocking. It was just like, I can't hardly believe that this is real, not only to the level of abuse, but to the volume of the individuals that are suffering this.
Interesting that there's actually a conference that would bring an awareness to a number of people, right? Is that quite common?
Oh, yeah. Well, there was a growing number of conferences back in the 2000s, and it has increased ever since, actually. So there's agencies that are actually, bringing a lot of attention to this issue, and there are a lot of individuals involved in the awareness campaign to bring awareness to different components of our society all over the place. So, yeah, there are places to go. We were in Oklahoma at the time. We joined something of a coalition that was fairly new. It was called Oklahomans Against Trafficking Humans. OATH was its acronym, and I believe that's still operational now. And so that they exposed us to a lot of that information and invited us to those conferences. And so we began to educate ourselves on what was going on. Here's the thing that touched our hearts, is that verifying the information that we were given as being accurate and true compelled us to come up with an answer. Because what a lot of people were doing were saying, well, all the, you know, parents need to know, law enforcement needs to know, school teachers need to know, hospitals need to know. Yes, that is all true. But just in knowing, it didn't actually accomplish rescue. And here's the other thing. If you could talk law enforcement into changing their paradigm, changing the way they looked at this, as this is actually a crime against humans and they need to be rescued rather than arrested. Mm-hmm. And that's a big if. Mm-hmm. But if they could accomplish that, they still don't have an adequate response for that victim, because now you put that woman is no longer a criminal. She's a victim. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now what do you do with that victim? They don't have an answer for that. Mm-hmm. So my wife and I decided to create an answer to that. And in Getty Refuge, as a service, as a residential program, is the answer to that problem or to that question. And as we looked at that, it was multifaceted. I mean, if you're going to take someone into their care, so the police say interrupt a sex trafficking ring, and they, instead of arrest the women, they actually offer them services. Well, what services are there out there? And when we were looking into it, there were only a handful in the entire United States that were specifically designed for someone in that situation. And yet there's hundreds of thousands of victims in the U.S. So we said, okay, what does this take? and we looked at it very practically. And the very first thing is you have to have housing. They come with no money. Mm-hmm. They come with no resources. They're literally, if you take them out of a trafficking situation where they're not living in the under the provision of a trafficker, they are homeless.
And they have no self-esteem left, do they? They have no self-drive or something.
The psychological trauma has layers to it. The social impact and ramifications of this experience have layers to it. So, yes, there's all of that. So you look at, well, one, they need housing, and that housing probably has to have some sort of supervision, because you take someone out of a traumatizing situation and a degrading situation, you put them, alone in a house or with a couple other ladies in a house, and they're just wrapped up in fear. Their imaginations are gone wild. They're suffering all kinds of psychological trauma. So you're going to have
they
to
might
have
even be violent, right?
The way they survived is their own sense of pecking order, which is verbal and physical violence mm-hmm. on each other. Mm-hmm. So there has to be some sort of a stabilizing influence within the home. And so we started to look at that. This has got to be a supervised home. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a plan for that. You're going to have food, utilities, clothing, personal items, and all those things. But more than that, and this is where our imagination really kind of jumped into high gear, as we started to think, well, it's not just a physical need. They have a psychological / social / emotional need that is very high maintenance. It's just going to require professionals. So we looked at the component of, okay, you've got them in a home. Now let's take and start having conversations with them from a therapeutic point of view. So you're going to need a trained trauma therapist and someone that understands sexual abuse at a very deep level. Mm. On top of that, you're going to need to help them engage and understand different life skills, relationship skills, ways of looking at themselves, their value as a person that they either missed or were deconstructed in their experience in sex trafficking. A lot of these ladies, and what stats have come out in the last 10 or 15 years that are showing us kind of how ladies get there. And 60% of prostituted persons or sex trafficked persons in the U.S. come from the foster care system.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So you've got this trajectory of broken relationships, family and emotional abandonment, and a social disconnect that sort of fast tracks these individuals into a vulnerable and violent situation that they think they need to propel themselves into or acquiesce to out of survival. But it's not coming from a healthy place of security emotionally.
Well, so tell me, Aaron, do you think that the Me Too movement helped at all? To bring people's awareness to the trap for women, or I don't know.
Absolutely. Well, what it did, the Me Too movement really exposed that the abuse on women, the systemic abuse on women, is not just to a poor individual, someone mm-hmm. without resources, or a foreigner. But it's happening at a high level. You get the exposure from Hollywood and from corporate America. And it's important to pull that Band-Aid back and take a look at that, because it's a systemic mentality in the male population. And so it did help expose it to people who even were high profile or high income individuals that are still suffering this. Mm. Yeah. So it all kind of interplays.
So we have people like, for example, Weinstein, or we have the whole Hollywood thing. Would you consider that to be sexual slavery? It's not the same, but it's the same. Would you say that?
It comes from the same place and the same sort of gender bias and gender abuse, but it just looks a little different. And in fact, that's really how abusers justify it. In fact, they justify prostitution classically or entirely that way. If I'm paying you, then your complaint is invalid. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm paying you for your acquiescence to my demands, no matter how degrading or abusive. Well, now that's one thing. If you got somebody on the street, I'm paying you $100 or $200 for a sexual encounter that lasts 30 to 45 minutes. And whatever I do to you is you have no recourse because you've agreed to a classically criminal activity. And so if you get hit or degraded or suffer pain in any way, then it doesn't matter, and you don't have an avenue of you don't have a recourse for seeking justice or retribution or anything because you agree to be paid for it. But you just take that same mentality and extrapolate it to a high end commercial agreement. So you've got a woman that says, "I'll agree to participate in a porn film." You know, for whatever she's paid. I don't know what the number is, $50,000 for a week or something like that. It's an ungodly amount of money for her. And then she gets used in ways she's totally not comfortable with, doesn't feel like she agreed to, and oftentimes did not agree to, but she's getting the paycheck. Mm-hmm. So in other words, she has acquiesced to resigning any legitimate claim against what happened to her. Mm-hmm. Well, you take that and you can extrapolate that same experience to someone who agrees to get paid $2 million to be in a Hollywood film. Mm-hmm. But in order to get that job, you have to agree to a sexual encounter with Weinstein or whoever it is. Wow. Agree not on a paper contract, but agree in the verbal and social exchange that it takes to get that part. It's all part of the same mentality. It all has the same markings of abuse. Mm-hmm. We just categorize it differently in our minds, which is an injustice in and of itself.
I want to say this that's fascinating to me. What you're saying is absolutely interesting, and I can't, and it hurts me for people for obvious reasons. But the word trafficking is a very interesting word because I think of it as like an underground or something. But really what happened in, for example, Hollywood or high pay for being abused kind of thing, that's not called trafficking, but essentially it is, isn't it?
Right, right.
So well, it's hard to draw the line is what I'm saying.
It's hard to draw the line. It's hard for us to accept the paradigm shift of how to look at it, but it utilizes the classic tools of trafficking, which is force and fraud. So if you're coercing someone against their will or their better judgment, or you're forcing them into a situation they would not agree to in a healthy state of mind, then you are exercising a form of trafficking.
Wow.
So
we really have to look at ourselves and our society, don't we, to, you know, really look
absolutely.
At this and really bring our...
Absolutely.
Because you also brought up that it's so interesting, too, that people who have been, I was going to say women, but people who have been really abused tend to be abusive, you know, in defense.
Absolutely.
And expect abuse so that they will be abusive. And so that it keeps a huge... rather vicious foment going on in the society, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So let's talk Absolutely. About the Engedi refuge. You called it a refuge. Is it called a safe
yes.
house? Is it called?
Yes.
Is there more than one? Do you have one safe house or do you have a variety like linking up with
yeah.
others?
We've actually developed a system that includes two different properties. And we found this to be a great asset. So we have one property where our safe house exists, and that is in an undisclosed location,
mm-hmm.
and it houses six women and one manager. And this is where we would receive women who are coming right out of a trafficking situation,
mm-hmm.
right off the streets. They come to us, usually not in a good state. still actively using drugs or something to numb their system. They come without resources, maybe a bag with clothes, maybe nothing but the clothes on their back, mm-hmm. no money, mm-hmm. No family support. But we make arrangements to bring them there to keep them physically safe.
Okay.
And then we provide everything that they need in that safe house. And so their bedding, their clothing, their personal items, food, everything.
Toothpaste.
The manager then toothpaste, do the whole kit and caboodle. Mm-hmm. We even provide spending money for them, on a monthly basis. What we ask when they come into the Engedi Refuge program is that they commit to staying there in the safe house for 6 months. That's phase one of the program.
Okay.
Now, there is no consequence if they don't feel like they can do the whole 6 months. But it provides a space of time where they can relax into a safe environment and they can experience some therapy and some education that is really helpful for them to move back into society in a different situation. So we ask them to commit to 6 months, but if they leave after 2 months, it's no big deal. We love them. We bless them. We're doing the best thing we can to help them just kind of break the cycle of abuse in their life. Mm-hmm.
Do most of them have people that find them, that look for them, or do most of them have no one?
It's different for each one. We've had a whole variety of scenarios of ladies that have come to the Engedi Refuge safe house. Some are being hunted, actively hunted by their traffickers,
okay,
or by the gangs that are associated with their traffickers. And so keeping that location secret is really, really important. Some are there waiting to testify against their trafficker. We've had, 20 or so women that have been in our program that have actually testified against their trafficker. And I think of those, about 15 traffickers have actually been convicted of crimes and put in jail.
Oh, good.
So what's helpful about this is the safety that they experience at Engedi Refuge allows them the time to experience sobriety and emotional stability, and it makes them makes a very credible witness when it comes to the court date and being a witness on a stand to provide accurate testimony against the trafficker.
Hmm.
So it's a great asset to law enforcement and to district attorneys as well.
Now, are you getting cooperation from law enforcement and district attorneys and the people in power of that sort?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're very thankful and grateful for what we provide. We work with different counties that have diversion programs, and we've been, one
What are diversion programs? What are those?
So a woman may be arrested with, for prostitution or something related, drug possession or drug distribution. And if it is intertwined, if they can prove that there was sex trafficking utilized against them, that they were not only did they commit a crime, but they were a victim of a crime that was related to sex trafficking, then they can offer them a diversion instead of being issued a 2 or 3 year jail sentence. They can divert that and agree to go into a program like Engedi Refuge, which is therapeutic in a safe home. And if they stay in that, then that actually counts as what would be incarceration. And so it's a much better situation for them to come to a program like Engedi Refuge that's safe, that is really investing in their therapy, getting trauma therapy, resocialization, learning life skills, making connections, being mentored in the community, learning vocational skills. This is a much better situation, very restorative, quite a different experience than just being incarcerated.
And how's the I should imagine, right? How's the success rate?
Our success rate if we measure what we call the rate of recidivism, recidivism would be just relapsing or going back to the abusive situation you came from.
Mm-hmm.
And our the rate of recidivism for ladies that have come to Engedi Refuge is only about 10%,
okay.
which means that 9 out of 10 ladies that come to our program do not go back to prostitution or sex trafficking,
wow.
or any form of sexual exploitation. That, and we are in relationship with agencies across the nation, and we've never heard of a success rate that matches that. So we are experiencing a high level of success. And what I think, there are several components that really feed that. I mean, one is the safe house itself, that we provide the physical space for them to experience safety. Two, we provide the counseling and education that gives them a therapeutic experience that's truly redemptive on the heart and soul level. Three, it's for a significant amount of time. And all of those things combined sever the tie psychologically from what they experienced in prostitution or in sex trafficking.
So they can begin to see a different life for them. They can actually begin to experience the possibility.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They experience the feeling of hope that life could be different. Very realistically, that life could be different for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that is vital to take a human soul who's been hurt and degraded physically, emotionally, and shoved into the corners of society and say, no, there's a path back to a place of safety and dignity and hope and good experiences in your future. It's necessary to do that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Being incarcerated doesn't necessarily do that.
No, I know that actually. Although there's some stories that talk about that, but I'm very, I want to say excited, but I'm not really excited because I'm hurt for so many people who are being trafficked, you know, and so that's a very painful subject for a lot of people. But you're getting more and more. Oh, and one more thing is the person who introduced you and I told me, and mm-hmm. I'm in Northern Washington. I'm on the coast here, which you are. And he said that the greatest port for sexual trafficking is between Vancouver and Seattle. Is that right? Do you bring mm-hmm. in people from that particular thing, or is that outside your jurisdiction?
Well, it's certainly one of the biggest. And it's just because port cities are a magnet for maneuvering people. There's the possibility of maneuvering people like in Seattle or Vancouver, not only on airplanes, but on ships.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, there's a highway system that takes it all the way down to Mexico on the I-5 corridor. So you've got modes of transportation and you have ways of concealing people that are very active on these port cities. But I think the numbers are kind of all over the place. I mean, Atlanta has been rated as kind of a number one in terms of volume around sex trafficking, but it kind of depends on whose study you look at and what year you're looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2010, there was a push to kind of examine what was actually going on in sex trafficking, and Seattle was the number one. Now, it may in the U.S., but it may have only been that because they had the most police cooperation in the study.
Oh.
So it's hard to tell. But,
it's hard to know
but,
what, yeah.
The volumes are really high. Their volumes are really high in port cities. And so you know, we're in an area that experiences that.
Mm-hmm.
But here's something that's really, really interesting that we've learned over the years. The former district attorney of King County, which is Seattle, did great work between, I think, the years 2009 to 2016 in changing the paradigm of how law enforcement responded to sex trafficking or classic prostitution or sexual entertainment in the Seattle area. Now, them focusing more on traffickers or people who are actually buying sex and pulling back from arresting or incarcerating anybody who was used in that system, like a prostituted woman, changed a lot of things. And what it did in the aftermath of that kind of refocusing and focusing their law enforcement and prosecution attention on traffickers, was it moved the traffic, put some pressure on the traffickers, and it moved them to the outlying areas. Now, we saw this actually happening across the United States, but they were measuring it in Seattle and around Washington. And he did a couple of conferences that I went to here locally, and he was straight up warning the law enforcement, sheriff's departments, and local law enforcement of smaller towns in more rural counties, that the traffickers are on their way to you. And they don't need a big city with a big red light district to run their operation. The internet has changed everything so that you can buy and sell a woman on your cell phone over the internet like a pizza. And
you're
that
kidding.
Person
no.
can be delivered to your house,
no.
to a hotel room, to a car. That person, the person wanting to purchase that individual can come to a location, a house, a hotel room, a car. And so you can do all this trading online. It's very secretive. And if it's done, you know, in the dark hours of the night, nobody sees it. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need women walking up and down the red light district at 2 a.m. where everybody knows what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
It can happen anywhere, and it is happening everywhere.
That can
and
be
for
kids.
The volume, it can be kids, and that's so insidious. But runaway children are so vulnerable. It's just scary how, in fact, there's been studies done that they say a teenager that runs away from home will be propositioned for commercial sex within 48 hours.
Oh, my gosh, really?
And a full third of those, statistically, a full third of those were given to that pressure.
So I want to ask a very naive question, is like, who are the traffickers? You know, are they trained in that business? Is it just, you know, criminal consciousness? I don't know. I'm going, who on earth are these beings?
Yeah.
Are they mostly men?
Yeah, that is a good question. And it's kind of a disturbing question. Because they can look like anybody, and it comes down to it in terms of the ones that are actually arrested. And when we start to get real time stats on what's happening, they can be men, they can be women, they can be black, white, Hispanic, or whatever. They don't fit the typical stereotype, because what we've been sold is the Hollywood version of Snoop Dogg all dressed up like a pimp.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
But that's not what they look like. That's not who it is. It could be anybody, because the money is so lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a trafficker could control four or five women in what they call a stable. And they use that term very purposefully, because it dehumanizes the women in his care. And I say care, quote unquote. He can make over $1 million a year tax-free money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's quite an incentive for anybody who's willing to play the game and take the risk. There are ways of doing it. In fact, there's been a guy that actually has put out sort of an instructional book on how to pimp women.
Really?
I mean,
really?
It's crazy.
You
how
think
much
he'd
you
put the book out and people would chase him down and put him in jail? Right?
You would think so, but there's been little pressure on these pimps.
But think about the integrity. Think of Epstein. And think of the the big name, big buck people that have been involved in his nefarious, gross scam. I mean, he's made billions of dollars, hasn't he? I know he doesn't anymore, but the people, the famous and high-end people that were involved with him, that was pretty upsetting for a lot of people, you know?
It's very upsetting. And I don't know all the statistics around Epstein's thing, but you know what I've seen in the news articles, it's very disturbing. But it also shows just how prevalent it is and how enticing it is for people with economic power who can make arrangements with somebody like Epstein to have sex with an underage individual.
Mm-hmm. That is so horrifying. I watched some of the interviews with a few of the young women and how they were kind of stalked in poor environments and offered, you know, a way out of that poor environment. Which is pretty enticing, isn't it? If you really don't know much about life. And so
it's very enticing. And so if you look at the global trend, is you have places of economic disparity, and those of economic privilege are actually targeting those communities, those countries, those cities across the globe, young people coming out of poverty and promising them a better job and actually enslaving them in the sex industry, mm-hmm. In the sex entertainment or classic prostitution. Once they remove them from their home and they don't control their own identity, documentation on paper, they don't control their own money, they're scared out of their mind, they're minors, they're in a country they don't understand, they may not even speak the language, they don't have agency over their own life.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're too afraid to leave. Now, you add to that not only just a situational manipulation like that, but then you add the physical violence and the threat which traffickers make all the time is, one, I will hurt you. Two, I know where I found you. I can get to your younger sister. I can get to your mom. I can hurt someone in your family. And that fear keeps them enslaved. I mean, it is psychological enslavement. So it's not just quaint to call it slavery. And to call those of us who are trying to remove people from that system as abolitionists,
mm-hmm.
that invokes the imagery of, you know, the 16th, 17th, 1800s in Europe and America of the classic slave trade. But it is literally true of those who are being enslaved either for labor or for sex. But sex seems to be even more prevalent in a lot of places.
And well, the way you explained so, it with somebody being threatened that their younger sister was going to be brought in if they didn't, whatever, I feel right. The twist in that people finally, it's a crazy twisted world that way, isn't it?
It is. Mm-hmm. I've been privy to stories that are just blood-curdling. Mm-hmm. There was one lady that we were helping years ago. And she started to tell her story in one of the meeting contexts that we had with her. And she was in what they call a stable. And that sort of dehumanizes the girls. But she's with a trafficker. And she was with, I think, about 15 other girls or so. And the trafficker, in order to kind of get all of them to comply with him, actually took them all out into the woods. He tied up one of the girls to a tree and he cut her hands off with a hatchet
No.
in front of all the other girls.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
This girl that was telling us, she said she was in his control and she's like 14 years old, terrified out of her mind. And as all of them were, that's the level of violence and abuse used against these gals. And that's just one story. I could tell you story after story after story of women who've been in our care
mm-hmm.
that have had similar experiences.
Really?
Some have been tortured themselves. And it's if you start to look at the real experiences and the real facts, and when they start to tell their stories and they have to be in a safe place to even venture to tell their story,
mm-hmm.
it becomes sickeningly criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And we need a society response that matches what we would do to anybody doing violent and heinous crimes. It's not cute. And the sexual entertainment industry is complicit in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel passionate about it.
I really am glad you feel passionate about it because you're making a difference. As far as I can tell, and I haven't checked it all out yet, but I feel like you and your wife have made quite a bit of difference with these people all the way along. But, you know, how do, let me see, what's the question? Do a lot of the girls, for example, come in from being a runaway, that whole thing? Or are they sometimes stolen from their households in the dead of night?
Yeah, the sensational stories are the ones where they're classically abducted.
Mm-hmm.
That does happen. But that's not the majority of people's experience.
Okay.
Usually they are coerced away from their home, whatever that looks like. And sort of the composite story is and which is really common, is somebody comes from a broken home. Maybe they're removed from their home by CPS, placed in the foster care system. They're in, you know, 8 or 10 different homes during, you know, from whatever, you know, from 7 years old to 13 years old or something like that. So they're not making an emotional connection with any particular family. Oftentimes in some of those foster homes, they've been physically or sexually abused. So they get to be 13, 14 years of age, and they just want to remove themselves from this chaotic home life. Mm-hmm. And they end up connecting because maybe they're out, they're partying, or they're putting themselves in places where people can find them. Mm-hmm. And they connect with an older man, a guy who's maybe mid-20s or mid-30s, mm-hmm. who befriends them, he wants to help them, he seems really friendly. And he agrees to kind of protect her, take her into her care, or he starts to spoil her with gifts and actually showing a romantic interest in her. Now, she's already been compromised, and she's in some way psychologically, they're often looking for a father figure, an older man to take care of them. Mm-hmm. And they're willing to get involved romantically, even, and they're just not doing the math in their head. I mean, why would a 28-year-old guy be interested in a 14-year-old girl?
Right.
But that doesn't seem like a big deal to them. So they leave their home, they move in with this guy. He treats her nice for a couple of months, and then he turns around and says, "Hey, I've spent a lot of money on you and I need some help. So, I want you to do some favors for some friends of mine." And they'll kind of term it that way. And she might be repulsed at the idea. Like, "I thought you were in love with me." He says, "Hey, I do love you. But, you know, if you just, you know, if you have sex with some of my friends, they'll pay us some good money. Mm-hmm. And we can save up big money and we could kind of get out of this situation." And sometimes they will just acquiesce of their own free will to do him a favor because of his demeanor or his language. Sometimes they resist, and then he'll turn around and get violent with her, mm-hmm. and he'll start physically abusing her and intimidating her and scaring the snot out of her, and she'll just acquiesce out of fear for her own safety. Mm. And once they turn that corner, then he starts to commercialize her. So then he brings in, on average, we're talking about 10 men a day, 10 sexual encounters a day of various kinds is the average. And so you just think about a 14, 15-year-old girl that's in that scenario, mm-hmm. and she doesn't have any power or agency of herself. She now can't leave him, and she is being trafficked sexually, and that's how it happens. So by the time they get out of that situation and come to an agency like in Getty Refuge, they may be 20, 21. I think the average age of women coming into our program is about 25.
I want to make sure we get some connection for people and how to be supportive as well. And how to approach people that you know might be in that circumstance, that kind of range. Are you able to talk about that?
So I would say, first of all, you need to be educated on what are the signs. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of them, and that's a big topic, but I mean, just in a nutshell, you know, if you notice your daughter's friend, a niece, a sister, somebody related to you or somebody close to you, enough for you to recognize some signs, and they're in a relationship where there's a great age disparity or economic disparity, and there seems to be control, and she starts to shut down socially or be pulled away from the family or from close friendships by this man or this individual, that's a red flag. Hmm. If there's signs, bruises and cuts, and there's signs of physical abuse, that's a red flag. If she just sort of, you know, loses all connection with people and it seems like this man is so predominant in her life that he's the only source of information for her, he can't leave her alone or go anywhere without her, or she can't go anywhere without him, that's a red flag. And when you see the red flags, you start to ask the questions that look at the nature of the relationship.
Is it really relevant to say she doesn't get along with parents or foster parents or whatever? Is that a big sign too?
Well, that happens with a lot of people, and that isn't necessarily a sign just because there's a relationship problem with parents or certainly guardians or foster parents. But But if it was a good and a positive and a fairly nurturing relationship, and then suddenly this man is in her life and his influence causes her to have a lot of angst and disparity and conflict with her family that is otherwise a positive relationship, then that's a red flag. Now, not every boyfriend who may be a negative influence is a trafficker, but you can start to look at that and kind of question the nature of that relationship and offer help and offer support and say, you know, the key thing is I want you to be safe. And especially if they give any information about, you know, being sexually used in a commercial way or just engagements that they're really uncomfortable with or are more than just, I mean, most people have a relationship with one person at a time. If they're like, I'm having sex with, you know, five different guys, you know, a day, or I mean, they wouldn't often say that, but you know, sometimes they'll give you kind of a peek at the tip of the iceberg. You know, well, I've been with some guys I'm not really comfortable with. That could be a flag you need to pay attention to, and offering them a sense of hope. Now, the other thing is, so that's kind of on a personal level, but big picture, if you want to be involved in helping society actually invest in an answer, then one, you need to participate in the awareness, what we call the awareness. But I mean, just being part of learning the right signs, learning what's actually going on in your community, and telling the right people who need to know, the parents, the teachers, the law enforcement agencies, even hospitals, the social service agencies that need to be aware of the volume of what's going on, where it's going on, the signs of what's going on, so we can all do our part to offer a hand to help. But beyond that, and I think, I mean, for our agency, there are very few agencies actually doing something super proactive, like in Getty Refuge is doing here in Northwest Washington. And so it's a matter of finding those agencies and getting behind them to support them, volunteer with them, and certainly support them financially. Because what we are doing is the most expensive part. You take someone into your care, and you've got not only the housing, and you've got the management and personal service of those people, but also we take on an entire program development, which is trauma therapy, life skills development, education, higher education, vocational training, and mentoring into positive relationship. We take on all of that. That takes a staff of people. It's a very expensive thing. But FYI, it's cheaper than incarcerating somebody.
I'll bet, hey? I'll bet. Also, because you might get very productive people out of people that were not particularly productive
for
the community.
Well, this is the thing. On the byproduct of having a program that is specified and focused on their particular needs and their particular emotional traumas and physical difficulties, on the back end of that, you have women that are educated, they're employed, they're reunited with their children if that's their case, and that's the case with a lot of them. They're maybe reunited with their family of origin if that's a safe group of individuals. They're making new friends, they're productive in society, and a lot of times they're actually giving back, helping the other women that are currently being trafficked to have some inkling of hope by being able to connect to them through these other agencies or these efforts, the efforts to rescue them and connect with them on the street, or the efforts to put them in a residential program like in Getty Refuge.
And do people bring them to you, to in Getty Refuge from these community organizations, or how do they find you?
Yes. So we're part of an alliance of other residential providers across the United States. We helped actually form, we're on the founding committee to form this alliance. And so now there's a network of agencies across the United States that are independent from one another. You know, they're not franchises of one another, but there is communication. We're working toward accreditation in terms of the kind of care that is provided and the organizational stability of each organization. And we touch on sort of some philosophical views of how to approach victims from that standpoint. And then we also have a referral system. So the referral system is up. Anybody can use it across the nation to a survivor or somebody who is representing a survivor or trying to help a survivor can get them in the system, in the referral system, and to a safe place within days. That didn't used to exist. Now it does exist. And we're really proud of that. You know, we can get them to a qualified agency within a short amount of time.
And anywhere in the country, you're saying, basically.
Anywhere in the country. Yeah. We have, I think, 91 members. It's called the National Trafficking Sheltered Alliance.
National Trafficking Sheltered Alliance. All right.
Right. National Trafficking Sheltered Alliance. The website is shelteredalliance.org.
Okay.
Shelteredalliance.org. And with that, you can find the referral system, and anybody that's helping a survivor themselves or a family member of a survivor can get them in the referral system. And we can, somebody from the NTSA will personally contact them and help them through that process and get them to a safe place within days. So we lean on that. And then, of course, we have relationships ourselves as Engedi Refuge in our county. We have a close relationship with law enforcement all throughout Washington State, really, and other service agencies, social service agencies across the state.
Did you all have to take training in order to be a part of it all?
Well, we had to kind of make up the training as we went. There wasn't anything official when we were getting started. So we trained ourselves. I mean, we did extensive study, went to a lot of conferences and talked to a lot of people, read some books. But we also, my wife and I, unlike many people that got into this, we actually signed up for an internship up in Canada. We were part of another organization for a year and a half, and they mentored us in all the aspects of this kind of ministry or service, and before we opened up Engedi Refuge in 2013. So we were as prepared as we knew to be, and of course we've learned through experience in the last 8.5 years of being open and doing this ourselves, and we've served upwards of 80 women, and you know, we've got a lot of experience under our belt now. And of course, now that we've established the alliance across the nation, we've been gleaning best practices from agencies like ours all over the country and collaborating in our own kind of cross training, cross education, and preparedness for serving this population.
Wow, it's really impressive. So that came up, you said 2013 you finished your internship, but things have mushroomed since then.
Yeah, there was a handful of agencies probably leading up into 2010. And since then, there's been a steady growth, and kind of look at a graph. And so, you know, when we got started in 2013, I mean, we may have been, you know, one of 15 residential programs in the entire United States. And now there's probably over 150. So it's been a steep growth curve. Yeah, a lot of people have just who've been educated about what's actually going on within our own society have responded, you know, just like my wife and I. So that's been encouraging.
That is very encouraging. I'm fascinated myself. Let me see what else. I want to make sure people can, and you've put the right information so people can get hold or people can tune in to these systems. I'm interested in this internship, too. Is that the kind of training that would include trauma release and life skills, or is it just?
Yes. Yeah, it was. And we found that and sort of crafted that idea on our own. It wasn't like an official internship. They were doing it. We came and said, hey, we're all in. We want to create a residential program, but we're not exactly sure how to pull it off. And they invited us to come and work with them. And we did that on our own dime. I mean, we just said we'll provide for our own need. Just let us come and work with you. So it wasn't like a program that was pre-prescribed. We sort of helped them invent it for us.
Oh, good. Yeah. Oh, that's perfect. Isn't that perfect?
Yeah. Well, sometimes you just have to be real proactive that way. You know. So for us, we've done a lot of forward thinking about how to train others, and we've had probably 4 or 5 agencies that have come to Engedi Refuge to be trained by us in a much different scenario. People will come for a few days, and we will give them all that we've developed in terms of curriculum and organizational systems and kind of the encouragement of our story. But we have yet to develop, but we really kind of have it on the radar to develop a long-term training program, maybe 6 months long. If somebody wants to come and invest in that, that would be exciting.
But also the trauma release, that sort of thing, is a very good foundational course, isn't it? It's not a long course either, is it?
Yeah, there's being trauma sensitive is really important right out of the gate. And we do all that training with all of our own staff and volunteers.
Okay.
But classically dealing with someone's trauma from a therapeutical point of view, we rely on professionals for that. We have a professional trauma therapist on staff at Engedi Refuge, plus we have two other professional trauma therapists in the community that volunteer their efforts and their time one day a week at Engedi Refuge. So every woman that comes to our program gets an hour a week with a trained professional trauma therapist, 1 hour a week for the time that they're here.
Wow.
Up to about 10 or 11 minutes. So that's a huge successful component of our program. And I would want to just put it out there too, just, you know, for you and for your listeners that, you know, if you want to get in touch with Engedi Refuge, you simply go to www.engedirefuge.com.
Is that E-N-G? Sorry.
E-N-G-E-D-I,
okay.
Refuge, R-E-F-U-G-E.com. And you can, you know, find us on the website. You can send us an email. All our contact information is there.
Isn't Engedi a wild animal preserve in Africa?
You know, a lot of people think that. That's the Serengeti.
Oh, okay.
No, Engedi is an oasis in the desert in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And it, for us, it's a word picture of providing a place of refreshment and safety in a hostile environment. So that's kind of what it means to us. And so we adopted that name, but, I want to put a shout out to the man that you initially had a phone conversation with.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a building contractor that actually spearheaded the effort to build in Engedi Refuge, a new and custom designed safe house.
Wow.
He had been germinating, this idea had been germinating in his mind for years, but we finally were able to break ground on this idea a year ago, and we just completed it a month ago and moved our ladies into it.
Isn't
and
that
he was
exciting.
Able to not only sacrificed an enormous amount of his own time and money to make this happen, but he involved multiple subcontractors from his realm of business and influence in the community to come together to offer free or deeply discounted services and materials to build Engedi Refuge, a state-of-the-art house in a very private location and a perfect design. And that's the kind of his company is DJ and DJ Contracting, by the way, mm-hmm. here in Whatcom County. So if you have a chance to thank him, bless him, or bring some attention to his good work.
I certainly will.
That's worthy. But it's a great example of how a community in any county anywhere could come together as a community project and build something substantial that actually makes a real difference. We have people physically filling this house that are literally and physically kept safe, that are brought every day to the Engedi Learning Center for therapy and education, so that they can be part of a program that helps rebuild their lives. This is a real solution to a real problem. And I would say if we could pull that off here in this little corner of Washington State, anybody anywhere could pull this off.
I love that. Also, I find it was very intriguing where you said before they used to look at the cities as the places for this trafficking. Now they're moving out into all kinds of rural environments. So having that community consciousness, you know, it's got to be kind of a contagious consciousness, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, it starts with having conversations like setting up a meeting. We've spoken in public places, public libraries, the community college, the university that's near us, different churches, different public venues, schools, high schools, and you just kind of create an awareness event and start to get the people in the community aware of what's going on mm-hmm. and feeling encouraged and empowered to actually do something proactive about it. And you can just change, you can change a lot, and you can change people's lives. The ladies that come to Engedi Refuge for safety and for help are just floored at how much the community is involved in reaching out to them, providing for them, loving on them, and providing everything they need to restart a much healthier life.
Wow. I'm so touched by that. Mm-hmm.
Well, when they're being trafficked and they're in the life and they're out there prostituting, they're in a very dark sort of marginalized component of human experience in society, and they feel so isolated. They have no idea that anybody cares. Mm-hmm. So to get them out of that situation and into a loving environment and a caring and a safe environment, they are really touched. I mean, dramatically touched at how much people care. They didn't know that otherwise. They're isolated from contact with the healthy elements of human society.
Right.
We need to connect that dot for them.
I guess I better say goodbye for now. But I'm a counselor, so I think I'd like to come on up and volunteer at some point.
Well, that would be awesome. And you live in Washington, right?
Yes, I live. I don't live very far from Bellingham at all.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. So I'm in the neighborhood.
We'd love to visit with you. Okay.
I would love to come up and meet you in person and see what's going on and perhaps be of further assistance. And maybe enough people will listen to this to really be influenced by your great work.
I sure hope so. Thanks so much. Thanks for taking the time to listen to me.
Oh, I'm very, very pleased that I have had the time. Thank you so much for all you're doing.
Great. All right.
Take care. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you all for listening. And thank you so much, Aaron Newcomb from the Engedi Refuge. What do you call it? The Engedi Refuge Safe House?
We just call it Engedi Refuge.
Engedi Refuge. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks so much.
Blessings.